With a plant breeder shingle in hand, today's guest, Dr. David West, geneticist and co-founder of the North American Industrial Hemp Council, left Big Ag 25 years ago. He was a pioneer, if not the pioneer, researching plant molecular markers, creating new breeds of corn. Seeing the germplasm heading for the chemistry lab, Dave moved over to become more of an independent researcher and hung his shingle with the hemp. With potential legalization in many states, I thought Dave could share some information that could put things in a historied and grounded perspective. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. David, thank you for joining us today to shed some light and truths about the impending hemp explosion. I'm kind of counting on you today to be the voice of reason here.
Okay, well, let's talk about the hemp explosion then. Is that what it's going to be? I don't know. You know, I'm kind of where the rubber hits the road when it comes to the plant science of this. And there's a lot of hyperbole. So the first thing I try to do is address this uber crop notion, which I think is unfortunate because it puts this burden on a crop that's trying to struggle back from a long period of, you know, more or less having a boot on its neck. And to make it, you know, will the crop save the planet, for instance?
Right. Excitement always leads to exaggeration. And, yeah. And then the hemp realm is no different. And it's the silver bullet syndrome. And we all know that the Lone Ranger is the only one with a silver bullet. So that's why, once again, I wanted to speak with you. You started out with Big Ag. You're a doctor. You've done a lot of research. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about your work with the corn. And I know it had to do with the markers in the corn.
Right. Okay. We'll go back a few years because that was, for me, over 20 years ago, actually closer to 25, so just to keep it in perspective.
Sure.
But yes, that's where I cut my breeding teeth, was in maize, and I was part of a project at a company that was named AgriGenetics. It was created around 1980. It was the first ag biotech company. And they raised, you know, venture capital, and they went around buying up smaller seed companies. I happened to be working at one of those smaller seed companies. At the same time, I was working on my graduate work at the University of Minnesota. And so factors kind of came together. I was in the right place at the right time, and I became the breeder that worked in between the molecular biologists and the people who were field-oriented. And that grew into a project where we developed the first map using molecular markers. They were the RFLP. For people who know about this and might be interested, it was the RFLP-type marker at that time, early on. Nobody had done this before. Right. And we created a molecular map of maize to show that it could be done and how it could be used. Now, today, and following on that work, just about every crop has a map that they can employ in that fashion. When I left that corporate world and decided to talk about hemp, the first thing I suggested was, let's do a map. I was a little ahead of my time there, I guess.
Yes.
But now 20 years later, 25 years later, I see that someone there in Boulder is talking that very idea, and I think it's great because the tool will be wonderful for answering some of the questions that are still outstanding having to do with the evolution and development and also the varieties of hemp and cannabis in general that you find. So,
yeah, I want to just interrupt. I'm sorry for one moment, because this really is pre-GMO, and I just wanted to let everyone know that the molecular markers really is not anything to do with GMO, and that's kind of when you wanted to jump ship, is my understanding.
Yes, actually. You know, I didn't really become a plant breeder to do some of the things that the industry wanted to do. I wasn't really into putting Terminator genes into crops or things of that nature, or making crops so that they could spray more chemicals on them. I come from a more organic orientation. Opportunities presented themselves. It was time for me to do something else, so I got off the bus. That was at the end of 1992. There I was. You know, if you're a plant breeder, you usually have some pretty substantial resources behind you, big corporations, lots of technology, big machines, capital intensive. So I found myself sort of wondering, what should I do now? I've got a plant breeding shingle, and I looked around, and I encountered people talking about hemp, but it seemed pretty obvious to me that they could probably use a little input from the real sciences. So I decided I had found my purpose in that, and I started investigating the history of hemp. And so that's how I got into it.
In finding that history of hemp, I think that directly leads into one of the problems that might be today regarding seed supply. And so maybe you can weave the history just for a moment into what's going on today with that.
Sure. Germplasm. All right. That word. I always put that word right out there. Germplasm. One word. And it's the stuff that plant breeders work with. It's the genetic repertoire of a crop. And as a plant breeder, if you're going to get involved with a crop, your first question is going to be, you know, what's the status of the germplasm? In other words, where's the seed? Where can I access varieties? So that was my question when I started looking at hemp. I said, well, you know, we used to grow the crop. Where's the seed? And right up the road from you there in Fort Collins, we have the National Seed Storage Laboratory. And so I contacted them, and I said, you know, did you store the hemp seed from the old industry? And the individual there got back to me in a few days. He said, we found some bags in the hall, literally. They hadn't apparently been stored or cataloged properly. It looked like it was from a 1949 crop, and the seed was all dead because, you know, so much time had gone by. And then he said something that just sort of, you know, rocked me back a little bit. He said, you know, if any of it had grown, we would have had to destroy it. I thought, oh, my God. That was kind of my introduction to what, you know, became a long list of kind of absurd circumstances that surround this crop. But because they didn't have the licenses to handle a controlled substance, if it had been alive, they would have had to kill it.
And
that's the circumstance we find ourselves in. So, unfortunately, we have lost the germplasm that was the basis of the industry historically in the United States. And when I discovered that, I started digging deeper, and it became an essay that was called Fiber Wars, which is available online. And I tried to dig into, you know, what happened to the seed, what about this seed. I learned in the course of this investigation that the USDA had operated a breeding program under a man named Lister Dewey up until 1933. They had produced probably the best hemp that the world had seen. It came about from the importation of Chinese hemp into Kentucky that happened around 1850. And when the Chinese hemp met the European germ pool, a lot of variation was released, and out of that variation, a new variety that came to be known as Kentucky hemp was bred, sort of by the farmer breeders, as opposed, because we're back in the 1800s, so it wasn't organized commercial breeding, but it was what farmers had been doing, you know, since antiquity, basically selecting. And so this new type of hemp developed and became the base of the industry that then operated until 1958. In 1958, the last of the Wisconsin industry closed its doors. So I wanted to know what had become of Kentucky hemp, and the answer was that it was now called ditchweed, and we had crews of people rappelling down from helicopters to pull it out. And I witnessed that.
Well,
one day I was in a field. I was out breeding my corn. And this helicopter flew over, and these guys rappelled down into a nearby field. And I made an inquiry what was going on. It turned out they were part of the cannabis eradication effort. And, you know, these things to the public, to the lay public, you know, they might seem to make sense. But once you've got, you know, some background in plant genetics and plant variety, you know, you kind of look at that and go, what?
Yes, yes. At first, I thought you meant that people were on the side of hemp. They were finding it. I like that visual a little better.
So what I did when I first, you know, started talking to people about this and when I became involved with the effort down in Kentucky was that I told them, hey, look, you got to get out there and collect this seed. And some people understood the seriousness of that, and I believe they have made some clandestine collections. But, of course, that's how they had to do it. Otherwise, they are in possession of a controlled substance.
Yes, I'm wondering about the descendants of Mr. Dewey. I want to put my hiking boots on and start tromping around Kentucky and seeing who we can find.
You never know.
Yeah.
Lots of stories in Kentucky.
Canada has such a huge supply for the world. Is it so different, their seed, than what that Kentucky hemp was, for instance?
Well, they're varieties. They're adapted to their own particular area. Breeding is for local adaptation. And the big thing with hemp is that it's a photoperiod-regulated crop. And because photoperiod is affected when you go north-south as opposed to east-west, you can't really move the varieties effectively. Now, that doesn't mean you absolutely can't move them. You can, but you will affect when the flowering takes place. I'm sure we're going to get to this eventually, so I might as well introduce it now. In 1999, I went to Hawaii to run the Hawaii Industrial Hemp Project there. And for that project, I had to acquire seed, obviously. And the seed that I got came from a Canadian company. So they were the standard varieties that they would grow up there. I was pretty sure what would happen when I planted that seed because I knew it was adapted to about 50 degrees north latitude. Now I'm bringing it down to 20 degrees latitude. And so the plants literally came out of the ground, and in about 1 month they went into reproductive phase, which isn't what you want if you're growing a fiber crop. What you really want with the fiber crop is that you maintain the vegetative phase of growth as long as you can. And since we're talking history, I'll fill in another little interesting point on that. The industry in Wisconsin that had grown up in the first decade of the 20th century used seed that was actually grown in Kentucky. So they would grow the seed in Kentucky, bring it up to Wisconsin, and grow it there, and the shorter night, really, caused the plants to remain in a vegetative state longer so that they got more fiber production and maximized their yields that way. All right, so here I am in Hawaii. I brought in the seed from Canada. I plant it in the demonstration. You know, it grows about a foot tall and goes to seed. So that was the first demonstration that I wanted to make to the people who wanted to grow hemp in Hawaii, is that, first of all, we do not have varieties for this latitude of what we would call hemp. As you get more tropical, of course, you're getting into the high test material, but it's not hemp.
Yes.
So then the next thing, what do you do? When the Hawaii project for me was kind of a platform or a stage even where I could sort of demonstrate the art of plant breeding. And I was pretty sure that I would run, these were not problems that were a surprise to me, like the photoperiod effect. I knew that was going to happen. So I sent a plant explorer into China, and I myself went to some other areas to try to get a collection of seed. And in that collection, I was able to identify varieties that were more adapted to southerly latitudes. And to get the cross, and which is, you know, in plant breeding parlance, that's, you know, what you got to do, you got to get the cross, which involves mating things that are flowering at different times and everything. And I managed that. I developed a progeny, and then by the time I concluded the project, I had plants that had grown over 10 feet tall in 3 months. So, you know, I was able to demonstrate what you have to do, the breeding that's going to be required. And though Hawaii is something of an extreme case, that's still going to be necessary throughout the United States as we attempt to bring this crop back, because we lost this vital elite germplasm that had been developed by the USDA. And that's kind of a sad story, because it means there's going to be a delay in getting varieties that will perform in our locale. And people kind of have to be aware of that and not make this a horse race. When I say that, I'm speaking specifically to the notion that I've heard coming out of Washington State that they want to have a year and a half trial. I don't know why a half. Anyway, they're talking about a year and a half trial, and if the crop, you know, doesn't sort of win the horse race there, then they won't move forward with legislation, I guess. That's silly. Silly is a nice word. You know, because, I mean, first of all, agricultural research, to get data that is solid and real, you need a lot of replication. And replication is over, replication in the site, across sites, across years.
It's seasonal,
so,
yes.
You don't want to put hemp at this stage in its development in a horse race of some kind. And if it doesn't win, then they're going to say, you know, well, it didn't win the race, you can't have it. That's not a good scenario. That's being set up to lose.
Right. Well, I would hope that in that year and a half, as they see things need to have more time, I would hope that everyone would snap to that before the project is put on the shelf somewhere.
Well, hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Well, see, they put a 3-year limit on the project I did in Hawaii, and then we went back and had to get that extended. And I told them, I said, if you're doing agricultural research here, don't put a time limit on it.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
Especially if you're not funding it.
Right. Yes. Well, Hawaii is an interesting place because they are so protective, and rightly so, about having any new plant introduced into the islands. And
oh, right.
And
that was a great concern. We didn't. And hemp has a tendency to easily go weedy. The thing is, if you look at the crops that do well in Hawaii, you aren't going to find many that are seed, planted from seed. Most of the crops are planted and propagated in a vegetative fashion. The thing about the biggest problem I had in Hawaii was the birds.
they love it.
Well, hemp seed is the Haagen-Dazs of seed, right?
Right. Yes.
So, and for the birds, and if you can imagine the situation, I had to put up this tall fence around my controlled substance, and on top of that, there was barbed wire, and
motion sensors.
The birds are just lining my, they're sitting up there on top of the wire, looking down on, this treat. They come from miles around. They found out where the good seed was.
Right.
So in the end, I had to put up a screen, basically, the type of mesh screen that they use in the fish hatchery business to keep the birds off from it. So a crop like that in a tropical environment is going to have problems. It's the birds for one. But there are a lot of other issues that they're going to have too. So,
yes.
not least of which being the need to breed varieties for that environment. So.
Right, and in on the opposite side of that, throughout the plains in the United States or Hungary or wherever, China, wherever they are, I mean, it's great that it can grow and be above the snow, and it serves
exactly
to really feed the birds in these times.
It does. It does, which is one reason we have a huge repository of hemp genetics in Nebraska. And it's really quite mind-blowing because of the extent of feral hemp growing in Nebraska. And recently I've written a testimony for the effort there that they want to bring hemp back to Nebraska agriculture. Oh, at least Nebraska is a place that would be appropriate for the crop. People always want to grow this crop in places that it's really never been adapted. I get frequent calls from tropical latitudes saying, you know, they're interested in growing hemp. And I said, well, fine, but you'll have to do some breeding first. And that's usually the end of the conversation.
Mm.
But where hemp grows, if you look around the world, you can draw a line at about 45 degrees, and that's where you're going to find hemp growing around the globe. And if you go down to Chile, where the hemp was first planted in the New World in 1545, again, you're down at that kind of a latitude. So that's, you know, where it's adapted. I happen to live in the state that was the number one hemp producer, and I live at 45 degrees, so, you know, where I live right now. But the people who push this crop frequently are in areas that it had never been a crop before. And so there's some harsh reality that enters into the conversation when you start telling them, well, we don't really have hemp for you.
Right. I don't want to make Hawaii the theme of this conversation.
Okay.
But I wanted to ask you, that is a place where they're on guard always about invasive species. And, you mm-hmm. know, if you look at it and go back a few hundred years, I don't know what percentage, but I think it would be pretty large of what species were invasive at one time in Hawaii and around the world, probably. But talk about the hemp and what it needs. When it's growing, what does it do to soil? Is it better or worse than other crops as far as what minerals or trace elements it takes up and maybe drains in
sure.
the soil? And
well, first of all, this notion that hemp grows without inputs, let's set that aside, is naive. Hemp needs water. Hemp needs fertilizer. Hemp is pretty good when it comes to the pesticide control, though. Although the European corn borer probably came to our continent in hemp. So it's not like it's resistant to everything there ever was. In fact, there was a pest in Hawaii that I discovered at night was feeding on my hemp. So, you know, again, it's this uber crop notion, like this thing has to come out with everything perfect about it. This is an agricultural crop. It's got the kind of problems that you would find. But to be honest and to be fair, it has fewer of them, okay? And one of the things that really attracted me to the crop when I first started learning about it, because I was kind of like a musician who's changing his instrument, and I had to go and learn how to play, you know, this new instrument. So I was reading all about it, and off the pages would jump these testimonials from people who said, oh, and by the way, the field was cleaned of weeds. And I went, whoa, you know, that's no small thing. Hemp grown for fiber is planted at high density. So the canopy forms and completely shades out the understory, and the weeds don't have a chance. And and on my website, I have a collection of these testimonies that say, we were able to go in and clean the quack grass that had been recalcitrant. We cleaned it out of the fields in 2 years growing hemp. So, it does have that nice agronomic feature. Another thing you were asking about the soils. Traditionally, the term hemp land was applied to the best soils. So hemp, like if you look, for instance, in the Ukraine, that part of the world that is still a major hemp-producing area, you find that the hemp lands were the best. They wanted the best soil, good tillage. They really went to a lot of work to make sure that soil was in good tilth. And so the idea that, you know, just because the plant can go weedy and can grow in some fairly difficult areas doesn't mean that's where you're really going to want to crop it, okay? It grows well in rotation with corn and on the same kind of soil that corn would grow on. So it really belongs back here in the Midwest as a rotational crop with soybeans. Back when I first got involved, I made contact with some people who were growing organic soybeans for Japan, exporting them to Japan, and they got a huge premium on their organic soybeans. But the problem was they couldn't find enough organically certified land, and weed control in soybeans is a difficult task. So I got together with a fellow, and we put together a proposal to the Wisconsin Ag Department that the idea would be to grow organic soybeans using hemp as the weed control in rotation. Of course, that didn't get funded or go anywhere. That was, you know, 1995 or something.
That's a great idea, though.
But I thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
I still think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, if you can grow hemp in rotation with crops for the wheat control, that opens up all kinds of possibilities. And then what you do with the crop after that can go in any number of directions. The fiber, of course, used to be the primary product, but the fiber is becoming a byproduct. First of all, the seed seems to be the new market for hemp, which means entirely different varieties than what you used to have for fiber. And, curiously, the real byproduct of the old fiber industry was what's called the herds, which are the inner woody core of the plant that gets broken up and becomes like little pieces of balsa wood. They've discovered this ancient use, combining it with lime to make what's called hempcrete for building products, and it has all kinds of positive environmental characteristics, carbon negative, in terms of insulation and vapor permeation, all of that kind of stuff. So right now, if I were putting my money in it, I think that's the direction that the crop has a huge potential.
Yes. Could you give us a little bit, when you talk about crop rotation, what would that look like? You would grow soy 1 year or 5 years and then do hemp for 1 year or 5 years, or how would that realistically look?
You know, agronomists would work that out empirically, but you'd probably have, right now you tend to go corn, soybeans, and perhaps alfalfa up in my area anyway, or else if you're down in Iowa, you're probably going corn, soybean, corn, soybean, corn, soybean. So you throw hemp in there anywhere, and it's a nice break. How many years? It would be one or two. It wouldn't be more than that. Soybeans, you usually don't grow for more than one at a time. So I would expect a rotation like that. Throw alfalfa in there for a good measure. You'd need that to stay in the field for about 4 years.
Cool. Well, I recently did read, and I'll let everyone know, just to give Doug Fine some good credit here. He's come out with a book. I believe it's coming out in April, entitled Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. And David, as you know, this is where I found out about you and sought you out for you to help shine some light here on this topic for us today. And I read that China is about to give up on cotton, according to one of his sources, and go more with hemp because cotton uses so many pesticides and cotton needs so much water. Now, but I've also heard that cotton has a way of absorbing toxins, unlike other plants, from the air. And I was wondering, do you have any information about that, and or peripherally, what would you say to people that are going to go with hemp and give up on cotton?
I would say to them, go for it.
Next week, we conclude with Dr. David West, geneticist. His website is newheadnews.com/hemp for more of this type of information. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.